You're listening to Medscape's In Discussion series on transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy, a podcast where thought leaders and clinical experts share their diverse insights and practical ideas for optimizing patient care. This series is hosted by Dr. Kevin Alexander, an advanced heart failure trained cardiologist and assistant professor of cardiovascular medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. Relevant disclosures can be found with the episode show notes on Medscape.com or the Medscape app. The topics and discussions are planned, produced, and reviewed independently of advertisers. This podcast is intended only for use healthcare professionals.
Hello, I'm Kevin Alexander. I'm a cardiologist at Stanford University. Welcome to Medscape's In Discussion series on ATTR-CM. Today, we'll discuss arrhythmia management in ATTR-CM with our guest and my co-Stanford faculty member, Dr. Ron Watellis. Dr. Watellis is a professor of medicine in the Division of Cardiovascular Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine and the founding director of the Stanford Amyloid Center. He's a nationally recognized clinician researcher whose work focuses on cardiac amyloidosis, heart failure, and the cardiovascular effects of emerging therapies. Welcome to In Discussion and welcome, Dr. Watellis.
Thanks, Kevin. Great to be here. I always enjoy getting a chance to chat with you about our favorite disease.
Ron, I've been asking everyone on the podcast an icebreaker question. So if you weren't an amyloidologist and heart failure cardiologist, what would you be doing in life?
So I suspect I'm more boring than your other guests because I'm going to choose another field in medicine because I'm not interested enough to have other lots of other outside interests. But I love internal medicine as a whole. I also work on the side as our residency program director. Within internal medicine, I love hem-onc. I tell my wife a lot, who's a hematologist, that I like to pretend I'm a hematologist, and she reminds me that that's exactly what I'm doing is pretending. I do love the field. I think from a science perspective, no field, I'm afraid cardiology included, has moved at the pace of hematology oncology. It's been really exciting over the last quarter century to see it evolve, and in some spaces, including AL amyloid, to be a small part of that evolution. So I think that's where I'd go.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I totally agree with AL amyloid. That's the perfect intersection between cardiology and hem-onc, and kind of living vicariously through the hematologist on that side, seeing all the therapies, interventions they're developing. Yeah, it's a very fun space to be in. I think what we're talking about arrhythmias, I'd like to kick it off with discussing atrial fibrillation, because I think that that's what we probably most commonly contend with in ATTR-CM patients. Could you talk a little bit about what the prevalence of atrial fibrillation is among ATTR-CM patients and kind of how does it relate to the other manifestations of ATTR-CM in terms of timing and so forth?
The prevalence is exceedingly high. So if you look at the major trials, it's upwards of 70% of patients have at least a history of atrial fibrillation, 60 to 70%, definitely not less than 60. So that's rather remarkable if you think about it. There's probably many reasons for it. Undoubtedly, some of it is just heart failure related, but I'm sure the atrial myopathy that you get with amyloid infiltration in the atria is a very big part of it. Perhaps a bit like in heart failure overall, we've thought of this for years, maybe as a bystander that we have to deal with to reduce the risk of stroke. But I think in recent years, it has become clear in heart failure, and in my mind, even clearer in amyloid cardiomyopathy, that atrial fibrillation, sure, the stroke prophylaxis is a big deal, but really rhythm management can be equally important. When I think about the advances in the treatment of ATTR amyloid patients in the last decade, clearly nothing's going to compete with the disease-modifying therapies. Those have been game-changing. But once you get past that, I think that between SGLT2 inhibitors, which is probably a topic for another day, and atrial fibrillation management, those have been the two biggest impacts and have really made a big difference for patient care.
I totally agree. And I liked how you framed that with the disease-modifying therapies and these other kind of non-disease-modifying therapeutic interventions, because I think that our management of ATTR-CM in recent years has become much more holistic of thinking of not only addressing the amyloid, but the other associated comorbidities. And I think atrial fibrillation is top of that list. When I see patients diagnosed with ATTR-CM, it's kind of, here are the disease-modifying therapies we'll think about. And this is to try to keep you stable and from progressing clinically going forward. But the things that might help you feel better in the near term are managing your atrial fibrillation. I was talking with Sarah Cuddy on another episode about heart failure management and titrating diuretics and so forth. Those are the things that from now to a month from now or a few months could really improve quality of life and functional status. On that note, what's your approach to management of atrial fibrillation, rate versus rhythm control, within rhythm control, how are you thinking about antiarrhythmics versus ablation?
Absolutely. And of course, there's the thrombus prophylaxis as well, which maybe we can get to separately. But so rate versus rhythm control. So I have become, and I'm curious what your practice has been, but I would say I have become much more aggressive in the last few years about rhythm control. I think most of us in the field in the past had taken a bit of a nihilistic view that the atria are so diseased that the ability to keep somebody out of atrial fibrillation once they've started having it in this disease is probably so poor that in general, the proverbial juice isn't worth the squeeze and just prophylaxis against stroke and rate control. And of course, many of these patients are auto rate controlled anyway because of conduction system disease. So you'd say, okay, you showed up in atrial fibrillation today at a heart rate of 80. Here's your DOAC and we'll call it a day. What has changed is a couple of things in my mind. Number one is just clinical experience. As we've gotten better with rhythm control, it makes an enormous difference for a lot of patients, clearly not everyone, but for a lot of patients, they feel so much better out of atrial fibrillation in this disease. Number two, and this has really been the game changer, has been the improvements in atrial fibrillation ablation technology, particularly with pulse field ablation, which clearly, yeah, again, has, I would say, changed the management of atrial fibrillation and heart failure, period. But the success rate is clearly so much higher when you use this in amyloid patients that now when I send a patient for a fib ablation, I have pretty high hopes for success. Maybe they'll ultimately need a second ablation. Maybe we'll end up needing to cardiovert them once or twice in the next year. But I generally feel pretty good that chances are we'll keep them out of atrial fibrillation most of the time. And that wasn't the case in the past. My experience is that conventional antiarrhythmics are tolerated terribly in this patient population. You know me, I don't like to be controversial, but I would say that I could not have disagreed more with the line in the 2025 ACC, not guidelines, but the statements on management, where it said that amiodarone is generally well tolerated in this population. I don't find that at all. I would say that patients, and we know, again, in general, a lot of patients don't feel good with amiodarone. I think that's much more so with cardiac amyloidosis patients, which makes sense given how bad their myopathy tends to be and also how rate dependent they can sometimes be. So I have gone from a place of most of the time not trying to pursue rhythm control, and when I would do it, generally doing it with amiodarone, to completely changing, rarely using antiarrhythmics with amyloid patients, and just sending them very early on for ablation. What's your approach been?
Yeah, very similar. I mean, I think that there's a lot of consensus among many amyloid experts that AFib ablations are highly effective in a large proportion of patients and can give them clinically meaningful improvements in functional status over extended period of time. I think like you outlined, the technology for atrial fibrillations has gotten a lot better as well. So I think that several things kind of happen in parallel. Yeah, I've been using antiarrhythmics far less than I was, you know, a few years ago. One question I have for you is, as the spectrum of patients we treat with ATTR-CM broadens, so those patients that say now we're doing a PYP scan because they have a carpal tunnel positive biopsy, and yeah, we find amyloid on the PYP, but their NT-pro is not that high. That's one end of the spectrum to the classic kind of class 3, class 4 heart failure patients that may have been in the ATTR-ACT trial. Is there a point of no return, I guess, so to speak, where you'd say, I wouldn't go for an atrial fibrillation ablation, or you'd still pursue it, but then say, well, you know, counsel the patient that maybe the success rate is going to be lower?
I think the only ones that I tend not to consider it in are the ones that we know for a fact have been in chronic atrial fibrillation for years and who have huge atria. And you know, maybe we should even think there, but I would say there it just seems low yield most of the time. But otherwise, no, I would say, sure, without a doubt, and there's data to support, no surprise, the later stage the ATTR amyloid patient is, the less successful rhythm control is, whatever you're pursuing. But that's not really the question, because also the benefit can be higher. You have a patient with NYHA class 3 heart failure, AFib, as you know very well, can be the thing that pushes them over, and now they're hospitalized. Now they've gotten much iller. Now they've developed kidney dysfunction because of their diuretics having to be increased, et cetera. So the benefit is larger as well, even if the success rate is not as high. So really short of, again, somebody who's chronically been in it, I will have the discussion and pursue it. There's always the question of, are they symptomatic in it? And it's tough, of course, because sometimes it can be subtle. Sometimes patients honestly forget that they actually did feel better a few months ago because it's been such a slow slide every single day. The way that if you see a child who's growing and you see them every day, you don't see them changing. And if you see them 6 or 12 months apart, you say, wow, you really grew a lot. And so when you're living with the disease every day, you may not necessarily realize the slide as much as somebody with you. So I often encourage them, let's at least give a cardioversion a try, if nothing else, and see if you feel better. And if you do, let's send you for ablation consideration. It's really been a paradigm shift. And as I said, I really think that that and SGLT2 inhibitors have made a huge difference independent of the difference that we know the frank disease-modifying therapies have made.
Yeah, so I think we've touched nicely on management of atrial fibrillation from a rhythm control standpoint. Of course, the other important part of that is stroke prophylaxis. I guess talk a little bit about what the risk of cardioembolism is in amyloid compared with other kind of all-comers with AFib, and then what's your approach to prophylaxis?
So this is a really interesting topic, at least it is to me, hopefully to others. We know unequivocally that the rates of left atrial appendage, in particular, you can occasionally get elsewhere in the left atrium, but left atrial appendage thrombus is very high in this disease and far higher than in atrial fibrillation from other causes. We know this from data from TEEs. We know this from data from autopsy. We know this from data with CMR. That is unequivocal. And with that, we can say unequivocally that all patients with ATTR cardiomyopathy who have atrial fibrillation or flutter should stay on lifelong, at least I would say lifelong anticoagulation. Now, we could quibble if somebody has a pacemaker and we have a way to monitor for it and they had an ablation and you're a couple of years into it and they haven't had any and you turn a monitor on, maybe you take them off. But in general, they should be on indefinite anticoagulation. Now, the tricky part comes to this question about transesophageal echoes before cardioversions. So the conventional wisdom has certainly been that the rate of thrombi in the left atrial appendage in the setting of cardiac amyloidosis is high enough that you should always have a transesophageal echo prior to cardioversion. And that's included in these sorts of consensus statements that you'll see. Now, as I'm sure you're aware, some of your old colleagues out in Boston published some data and kind of editorializing on this policy 2 years ago. And they said, look, we've done a bunch of cardioversions without transesophageal echo on anticoagulation, of course, and nothing bad has happened. And when we did do transesophageal echoes, we found a bunch of thrombi, and then we didn't do cardioversion. And in some of them, we would repeat it, and the thrombus would still be there. And then, you know, we switch them to warfarin, and then they'd still be there. And so they were advocating the thrombi that will embolize are fresh thrombi. And so even if you find old thrombus there in the left atrial appendage, and a patient who's been on systemic anticoagulation for weeks, months, or years, that is really unlikely to embolize. And they may be right. And I would say, I don't know about your experience, but I certainly have experienced exactly that, where we have patients who undoubtedly, or we're pretty sure, would benefit from maintenance of sinus rhythm, and we just can't get there because they have persistent thrombus. But once you know it's there, nobody's going to feel good about saying, okay, we're just going to close our eyes and proceed in cardiovert, even though we know you have thrombus there. So it's an interesting debate. I would say, in my mind, it's still an open one. I think the conventional wisdom remains to do transesophageal before every cardioversion. I mean, if they had one 2 days earlier, he wouldn't necessarily repeat it, but otherwise before every cardioversion. And that is my general practice. But I must admit, I would love to see actual prospective data where this is looked at, because I have a feeling that the reality is that we harm more patients than we help, that for one stroke that we might prevent out of Lord knows how many, that we are condemning many more patients to symptomatic atrial fibrillation, which again can have a huge impact on quality of life. So I'm curious, do you take 2 T's before every cardioversion?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think for a lot of the reasons you outlined, I agree that there's clinical equipoise there to look at this prospectively. It'd be great if we could pull together some of our centers to think about how to design a study like that, because this is a very patient-centered question. I think that the paper from the Brigham is very provocative. And so hopefully that will kind of galvanize groups to think about this in a prospective way. I think also too, probably the risk is not uniform across demographics and age and that sort of thing as well. Mm-hmm. But I definitely agree we need to look at it more. And this kind of is a little bit of a segue into the next topic. I'm sure that these are SGLT2 inhibitors and atrial fibrillation management have also changed the natural history and the placebo groups in the more contemporary clinical trials and probably contribute as well to these lower event rates because these things are being done in parallel with our study of these disease-modifying therapies. On that note, you've been involved with pretty much all the ATTR clinical trials, and you've been leading some analyses looking at arrhythmia, particularly atrial fibrillation outcomes in the trials. Could you share some of what you've been working on and what some of your takeaways are?
We looked back with ATTRACT, the tafamidis clinical trial, and looked at atrial fibrillation, both in terms of the prevalence of it as well as to see how much it mattered. So the prevalence, again, in the 60 to 70%, you can just take that to the bank. That's every analysis you do, it ends up in that range. The question of its effect was interesting. We looked at it in two ways in a pre-specified model where we said we're going to consider these known factors that affect outcomes. It had a very notable effect that a hazard ratio of 0.55 on mortality of not being in atrial fibrillation as compared to being in atrial fibrillation. And that was accounting for TTR genotype, in that case, treatment of getting tafamidis or placebo and NYHA class. When we opened it up to a much broader model that had 23 different covariates, it fell out. And it fell out pretty clearly because it was, of course, a marker of heart failure. So that is to say, it fell out as a predictor of outcomes. Now, that's a totally separate question than what we were just talking about is, well, can you improve outcomes by addressing the atrial fibrillation? This is just saying, does it independently predict? And that was the analysis from that. We've looked at this in the ATTRibute-CM trial as well with acoramidis. This was the most rigorous assessment of atrial fibrillation in an amyloid trial to date, where we really looked at it from lots of different ways. Were they on baseline medications specifically indicated to be for atrial fibrillation? What did their ECGs show? The ECGs that were done throughout the study were analyzed. Is this new atrial fibrillation? We looked at AEs and treatment emergent AEs. So really as thoroughly as it could be looked at. Again, we see that same 60 to 70% figure for the prevalence of atrial fibrillation at baseline. What it showed was that there was at the very least a trend that the patients who were treated with acoramidis were less likely to develop atrial fibrillation. It kind of depended on how you looked at the definition, but there was at the very least a strong trend, if not more than that, and that makes sense. The other thing is that the positive treatment effect of acoramidis was the same regardless of whether you had baseline atrial fibrillation or not. So atrial fibrillation should have nothing to do, in my mind, with saying, you know, of course, should we put a patient on therapy? And I don't think we really have evidence to say, well, they have atrial fibrillation, ergo, we should choose this therapy or that therapy. But I do feel like it gave some evidence to say, no surprise, because their cardiomyopathy is presumably not getting worse, at least not nearly at the same rate as patients on placebo. Probably you're going to have less atrial fibrillation with time as well.
Interesting analyses, and I'm really keen to see what comes out, hopefully, from Helios-B and CardioTransform and these other trials that are kind of coming down the pipe. I wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk about some other kind of rhythm management that we encounter in amyloid and discuss conduction disease, whether that's AV block or more commonly chronotropic incompetence. I think that's another area where we can offer the patient's management of those things and can improve functional status in certain scenarios. I don't think it's probably quite as universal as SGLT2 inhibitors or your atrial fibrillation, but maybe kind of walk us through what are some of the conduction issues that you commonly see in amyloid patients and you know, when you're seeing folks in follow-up, what are the things that you're thinking about and what, you know, what kind of interventions?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think rhythm management is such an important part of ATTR cardiomyopathy management, but conduction disease is the other big one. We all know it's very common. It's not infrequently how a ATTR-CM patient might present, is showing up in heart block and needing a pacemaker. I am curious if you do the same. I get an EKG at every single clinic visit for patients with amyloid because both progressive heart block and atrial arrhythmias are so common. And you can't necessarily even count on just picking it up from exam because if it's flutter, obviously it could be regular. If you have an escape rhythm, it could be regular. So I get it every time and I pick up arrhythmias all the time with it. There's some things that are easy, obviously. A patient shows up with complete heart block, they're going to get themselves a pacemaker. The tougher ones are the patients with, let's say, PR interval of 350 milliseconds and a QRS of 150 milliseconds, where you know the day is going to come that in the not too distant future that that's going to give out and they're going to show up in complete heart block. The patient that, as you said, just has chronotropic incompetence, they have sinus node dysfunction or enough dynamic AV block that they just can't get their heart rate up. And so I think when you're taking the history, if there is data to suggest that and they have baseline conduction disease, that's worth interrogating. And obviously that could be interrogated as easily as putting them on a treadmill and seeing what happens. A pacemaker is not that big a deal. And so if there's evidence that they are at really high risk for progressing to complete heart block, or there's obvious chronotropic incompetence, I would certainly talk to them about pacing. Now, the other consideration, of course, is what kind of pacemaker. And I would say there is limited data, but it certainly makes sense that RV pacing is not ideal in this disease, even if they have normal ejection fractions. And so I would advocate always for conduction system pacing or this traditional biventricular pacing.
Yeah, I get ECGs pretty much every visit as well, because like you're highlighting it, it can be unpredictable. You can have risk factors, but they can develop the conduction disease at any time. And, you know, at least with that 6-second snapshot, it can kind of help you triage a little bit. One nice thing is a lot of patients, at least in the Bay Area, have wearables these days. Mm-hmm. So that can kind of give some longitudinal monitoring as well. I think pushing for CRTP, if they need a pacemaker, have a high likelihood of, you know, having a pretty high RV pacing burden. Sometimes I get the question in the community about CRTP versus D. What do you think about that?
I think the data, as well as clinical experience, is pretty clear that sudden cardiac death from ventricular arrhythmias is pretty uncommon in this disease, like really quite uncommon. Even if you pick up some NSVT, either on a outpatient telemetry or on, let's say, a pacemaker that someone has, to me, that's not enough to put a defibrillator in. If you have a patient with an ejection fraction under 35%, though that, of course, has not been validated specifically in amyloid, it's largely considered a reasonable reason to put a defibrillator in for primary prevention. So there, I would at least have the discussion and many patients would opt for it. But otherwise, unless we have evidence, let's say on ambulatory telemetry, that they're having symptomatic ventricular arrhythmias or syncope or presyncope from ventricular arrhythmias, I tend to just go for the pacing.
The other thing that I think comes up sometimes are these left atrial occlusion devices. And someone has a risk factor for bleeding, let's say chronic GI bleeds, et cetera. Do you use these devices in ATTR patients? And if so, what are some of the scenarios?
As you're well aware, a little bit of the shine has come off these devices in the last few months, again, even outside of the amyloid world, where it's not totally clear that there's total equipoise from a stroke risk with this. But I think the word you said before, the phrase you said before of patient-centered is applicable here. For patients, if the question is going to be, they can't be on long-term anticoagulation because of chronic GI bleeds, epistaxis that can't be controlled, what have you, there's little doubt in my mind that a left atrial appendage occlusion device is a superior thing to them just not being on anticoagulation. The other thing is, again, the patient voice matters here. And there are some patients who just do not want to be on anticoagulation. They cannot stand the fact that every time they scrape their arm against something, they get a big bleed. I think it's fair to have a discussion and say, look, particularly in this disease where we know there's a higher risk of thrombus, there's lower flow states in the left atrium just because of the degree of heart failure that often goes along with this condition. There's a real atrial myopathy here. We don't know that this is as reasonable a plan here as it is in other heart failure. That being said, it also is not unreasonable. And if you really strongly feel that this is your preference, and you accept that there is a possibility that there's a modestly higher risk of stroke than if you just took your DOAC, I'm fine with that. In the same way, frankly, you know, apropos to what we were just talking about, if I had a patient and the patient said, look, I don't want you to do a TEE. I've been on a DOAC for 6 months, and I know how I feel when I'm in atrial fibrillation. I will take on that risk. I think it's reasonable. I don't encourage it if they don't have a good reason, like chronic GI bleeds, but I don't have a problem with it if they want to pursue it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. One of the themes, in caring for amyloid patients are that there are a lot of areas like this where shared decision-making is extremely important. That's one of the aspects I really like about it, is that you need to spend time with the patient, weigh the pros and cons. It's usually a very detailed conversations and rapport you build with patients to navigate this decision as well as others. And I think that that's one of the aspects I like of caring for patients with cardiac amyloid.
I totally agree with you. And I think that the other thing that's very real to anyone who manages this patient population is that for the most part, you are dealing with elderly patients who, you know, are not going to live forever. And it may not be because of their amyloid disease. They're 85, 90 years old. For most of them, the quality of life is the part that is by far the most important to them, and often more important than quantity of life. Now, fortunately, our therapies in this disease generally align with both, that the same thing that's going to make you feel better is also likely to make you live longer. It's definitely true of the three approved disease-modifying therapies. That's often where the conversation focuses on, and that's kind of what I mean, where it says, hey, if you just cannot stand being on this long-term anticoagulation and you want the left atrial appendage occlusion device, it falls under the range of reasonable. And I'm not going to sit on the big soapbox in the ivory tower and say, yes, but we don't yet have randomized controlled evidence in this population that makes me comfortable that this is equivalent. It very much is, we are trying to help people live longer, yes, but very much live better and live better aligned with what matters to them.
Yeah, well said. So, wow, I think we covered a lot of topics in a short time. Today, we've talked to Dr. Watelis about arrhythmia management in ATTR-CM. Some of the big takeaways I had from this conversation was the prevalence of atrial fibrillation and the advances that we've made in terms of shifting the thinking around rhythm control and being more aggressive with it and getting good results. And so probably continuing to broaden our usage of that in clinical experience. Conduction disease can be fairly common as well, and requires kind of longitudinal monitoring, and patients can, you know, sometimes need to be managed with pacemakers, either RV pacing or CRTP. But these are things that we follow in our patients longitudinally. And then decision-making around anticoagulation and stroke prophylaxis for the high risk that we see in ATTR-CM patients. Overall, we should be using this in everyone, but like a lot of things in life, shared decision-making is extremely important, and there can be non-anticoagulation options to consider in certain cases. Thanks so much, everyone, for joining us for this podcast. This is Dr. Kevin Alexander for In Discussion. And thanks, Ron, for joining.
Thanks for listening to Medscape's In Discussion Transthyretin Amyloid Cardiomyopathy podcast series with our host, Dr. Kevin Alexander. Be sure to look for more In Discussion episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Check out Medscape.com or the Medscape app for show notes, links, and more information on transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy.